The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'm going to turn it over to Amelia.
Sorry, I was laughing really hard about the lights, so I'm going to just get some water before I start to talk. I'm really excited to see this room pretty packed because housing is a really exciting topic and something that I think all of us should be super interested in. So as a complete nerd, I have a Google alert on my email for the term housing crisis. And I can tell you that quite authoritatively that this is a phrase that gets tossed around a lot these days. And I can also tell you that this phrase is often follows the words solution to the. So some examples of these innovative solutions to the housing crisis include homes built from decommissioned shipping containers, tiny homes, 3D printed homes, micro units, granny flats, inflatable homes, homes made from recycled plastic bottles, and of course, everyone's favorite hashtag, van life. Now, of course, I'm being facetious, but there's something really telling about the kinds of housing solutions that we see advanced in the media and also in our city councils, in our think tanks, our policy schools, and our planning firms. The things that these all have in common is that they've accepted that the private market is not only capable of solving the housing crisis, it is going to represent the limits of our creativity when it comes to devising solutions to it. So these solutions might be advanced through technological innovations or building techniques like the ubiquitous shipping container that we see all over, or they might be through policy tinkering. But you can bet that the solution to the housing crisis is going to be coming from firmly within the ideological and creative bounds of the system that created the problem in the first place. Which is why I think the left and all of you here today have an extremely important role to play in movements for housing that's not only not in crisis, but it actually supports and unites and empowers us as humans. So that's, housing is magical. Seeing as I've only got 20 minutes to talk about this huge topic before we hand off to Tim, I want to do a couple things in my portion of this talk. First of all, I want to look at the myriad functions of housing under capitalism. I also want to discuss the meaning and the lived experience of housing crisis and briefly sketch out some of the trends that we can observe in housing today, focusing primarily on the U.S. And I know that that's a super limited context, but this is 20 minutes. Finally, I want to explore what solutions are made available under our current social relations and which ones are not. And then Tim is going to take it away from there with a discussion on housing struggles, demands, and visions. So under capitalism, a home has a huge number of functions. At its most basic level, housing serves as shelter from the elements, which is something so essential it's almost like an extension of our human bodies. It's also a shared space where we become socialized, where we form our habits and our identity and our culture. Our homes are also the primary site of social reproduction, all the cooking and cleaning and bathing and child rearing that goes into getting workers to work and raising children to adulthood. It's a place where hopefully we can find refuge from the challenges that we face in our workplaces and our public lives. For me, that means a place to drink beer and watch Shark Tank with my cats. For others, maybe not. But home isn't always a refuge either. For many, the domestic sphere can also be a place of struggle and abuse and violence and real challenges. Housing under capitalism is also hugely important in determining our opportunities in life. The neighborhood that you grow up in reflects your level of health, your education, your job prospects, the dangers that you'll face in your life, and how long you'll live. So there's a 20-year gap, I'm sure you all have heard, in life expectancy between rich and poor neighborhoods in the city of Baltimore. And in Sandton, where Freddie Gray grew up, unemployment and poverty are just off the charts compared to the national rates. And the incarceration rate is 7 times the national rate. So when you think about that in the context of his murder, this made him a lot more likely to be, taken into custody and brutally killed in the hands of the police department than someone growing up on the opposite side of town. Or consider the role of housing in the irreparable damage done to children in Flint, Michigan. In Flint, the failure to replace the lead service lines in the residences combined disastrously with conditions of austerity to poison an entire generation, and the consequences of that are not even fully understood yet. So all this is because the implications of the places where these people lived in the context of capitalism. So for homeowners, a home is an investment as well, and it's the main source of wealth that's passed down from generation to generation, determining the opportunities of one's children and grandchildren and so on, assuming you can hold on to it, because housing is actually also a really huge burden. It's the biggest living expense for most households, and it costs a massive amount of money to maintain physically and financially. Outside the home sphere, housing is also a source of profit for speculators, flippers, investors, and landlords. the job of a landlord is essentially to charge rent on the exclusive access to homes. What a job, right? Housing also serves as a spatial fix for capital. In other words, a place to invest money in the built environment when it can be it can't be profitably invested in other spheres. So it's an opportunity to put capital into motion so it kicks back rent payments over time. With declining profit rates in a lot of other sectors, urban development has actually become one of the major forces in the economy post-recession, in stabilizing the economy. And actually, much of this is due to the urban mega projects in places like China and the Gulf states. For the government, housing is also a major source of tax revenue, contributing billions to city budgets. And despite past attempts in the U.S. to change the inequitable way that education is funded, which we're all aware of, property taxes also form the basis of school budgets. So, meaning children's educational resources are closely tied to the home values in the neighborhoods where they grew up. So, in short, as a commodity, a home has both use value and exchange value, and allowing me to watch TV with my cats on one hand and enriching my landlord on the other hand. Clearly, these two types of value are sometimes at odds with each other, because the prioritization of the exchange value of commodities over their use value under capitalist systems, situations of extreme absurdity and injustice are often created. For instance, it's often cited that there are enough empty homes in this country to house all homeless people, maybe even several times over. I'm not going to contest that. This is especially true in cities that have experienced speculative real estate booms. David Harvey claims that his favorite pastime is to walk around posh districts in the evening and count how many lights are on, how many people actually are occupying the luxury flats. And the answer is not many, of course. In New York City, there are around 65,000 homeless people. And at the same time, there are more than 250,000 vacant housing units in the city, 100,000 of which are simply vacant because they're Airbnbs or crash pads or investment properties or who knows, they're just being held off the market. Harvey's right when he says that we're building cities for people to invest in, not to live in, for exchange value and not to meet the needs of real people. And this is why Elon Musk has been able to purchase 5 mansions in Bel Air with no consequences while people are still homeless in LA. And we know that there's no profit incentive for housing people who have no way to pay for it. So this is a state of affairs that's likely to persist into the future. Shelter as a concept is ancient, but in the history of human settlements, treating our dwelling space as a commodity is actually relatively new. And this was accomplished in famously dirty and bloody fashion through the process of dispossession and enclosure, which created the conditions for those who suddenly owned the land to violently expel and exclude people and deny them the right to live on that land and collect resources from it. So this was not a pretty process, and these are the ugly and unjust roots that ultimately enable and, in fact, guarantee housing crisis into the future. I'm going to grab some water. Hold on. So in Engels's time, the acute housing crisis looked like a severe shortage of decent housing for working class people who were living in extremely overcrowded and unhealthy conditions. But pushing against the idea that this crisis was an isolated event, Engels wrote, "This shortage is not something peculiar to the present. On the contrary, all oppressed classes in all periods suffered more or less uniformly from it." So what he was saying back in 1872 when he wrote this was that housing crisis isn't an aberration in an otherwise functioning system. It's the status quo for the working class. Madden and Marcuse write in Defense of Housing, which is up here, that the reemergence of the term housing crisis since around 2008 reflects more the experiences of the middle class, who were suddenly and unexpectedly facing the experience of housing crisis that the working class had always been facing. This was merely an amplification of the broader tendencies toward insecurity in capitalist societies. So in Madden and Marcuse's words, housing crisis is a predictable, consistent outcome of the basic characteristic of capitalist spatial development. Housing is not produced and distributed for the purposes of dwelling for all. It is produced and distributed as a commodity to enrich the few. Housing crisis is not a result of the system breaking down, but is a system working as intended. And for millions of households, the word crisis is actually a pretty apt description of the daily instability, fear, and disempowerment that they experience in housing. So what does housing crisis look like today? First, homeownership, the main source of equity and intergenerational wealth transfer, is totally out of reach for even many people with a stable income. In most U.S. cities, people making minimum wage can't even come close to affording a home. And for example, I was born in San Francisco, but in order to buy a typical home there now, I would have to make $300,000 a year, which one article calculated was 33,600 avocado toasts. I don't know why that's a helpful unit of measurement. So for those in the rental market, conditions are similarly bleak, marked by skyrocketing rents and unsustainable rent burdens. Recently, it was asserted that in no U.S. city can someone making a minimum wage afford to rent a typical one-bedroom apartment. In San Francisco, a person would have to work full-time earning $60 an hour just to afford one bedroom. And across the bay in Oakland, it's only $45 an hour, so don't worry. Oh, good. And this burden is also disproportionately borne by people of color, who are much more likely to be renters as a result of the legacy of inequality in housing, which we'll certainly get into more. These days, there are few limits in place to keep rents at reasonable levels. In all but a few cities, rent control restrictions faded with the post-war housing shortage. We had them back after the war. And 35 states, including Texas, where I live, have actively outlawed rent control using a statewide preemption. So some cities have rent stabilization, thank you, which limits price increases. But when rents are allowed to be increased to market rate when a building is sold or when tenants are turned over, rents still can jump out of the reach of the majority of tenants. Eviction is a constant threat for the working poor and unemployed and keeps many families on the verge of homelessness. Sociologist Matthew Desmond has shown that in Milwaukee, while black women make up 13% of the population of the city, they account for 40% of the evictions. So often these people are evicted from their rental residences with children, with jobs, with all sorts of responsibilities that they have to shoulder. Displacement from the U.S. cities has also meant an increasing suburbanization of poverty, which the working class is pushed out of central cities and faces longer commutes from the homes that they can actually afford way out in the burbs to their low-wage jobs, keeping the cities running every single day. Those who require assistance in the form of public or subsidized housing face endless or even simply closed waiting lists or lotteries that serve only a fraction of those who are in need. Because of the decades of cuts and the lack of current funding, demand for subsidized housing is always higher than its supply, and those who can't afford to pay market rate are basically left with no options. And we can't forget that the foreclosure crisis, which, you know, is arguably still in its waning phases, has been one of the most massive transfers of wealth in U.S. history. Hundreds of thousands of families saw the extent of their property transferred to the banks, and to add insult to injury, those families were blamed for having non-traditional subprime mortgages, as if it were an individual failure on their part. So the working class today faces exacerbated conditions of this constant crisis, and I can't go any farther without highlighting the extremely unequal burden on people of color who've been at a disadvantage of every stage in housing. Black and Hispanic families have disproportionately been shut out of the housing market by racist mortgage and real estate discrimination. They've been excluded from federal programs that were designed to encourage home ownership. They've had their homes and property forcibly taken away through urban renewal. And as a result of all this, today black wealth in this country is an average of 5 to 10% of white wealth, which is just criminal. And housing is one of the major reasons why. People of color are more likely to live in areas where they're exposed to hazards like industrial pollution or toxic chemicals or substandard housing. And for example, in Houston's historically black neighborhoods, there are still open drainage systems. And this is a city that floods constantly. So when flooding occurs, there's nowhere for that water to go except into their homes, which is extremely devastating. And it's been communities of color that have faced the instability and displacement that comes from gentrification. So even though the Fair Housing Act was signed in 1968, forced through by the threat of urban rebellion and the murder of MLK, we're still headed, as the Kerner Report famously stated, toward two separate and very unequal societies. So clearly, the most obvious solution to housing crisis is to build housing, and to build it safely and comfortably and in locations that make sense for the people who need it, and to employ people who need work to build and maintain it. Sounds nice, right? But the trajectory of housing in the U.S. has pointed decisively away from this. Few people can remember a time when our government was actively involved in the direct provision of housing, but it did happen. During the time of housing crisis and the Depression, direct provision of housing was the norm. At the time of the Hoovervilles and the Pipe City, the federal government was acutely aware that if they didn't act, they were going to have a lot of angry, desperate, radicalizing people on their hands. So under relentless pressure from workers and socialists and reformers, the first civilian public housing in the country was built through the New Deal era Public Works Association, using quality materials and solid construction, some of which still exist today if it hasn't been demolished. The federal government provided mortgage relief through the Homeowners Loan Corporation, and they subsidized the mass construction of the new suburbs and offered them to families with irresistibly low financing. And while it might be tempting to look back on this these policies enviously, they're also really helped to cement racial inequality and were extremely important in setting up the decline of public housing. Reflecting the class and race bias of the Roosevelt administration, the public housing projects were primarily designed for those of moderate income rather than the poor, and they were totally segregated by race. Mortgage lenders relied on the infamously racist redlining maps that color-coded risky areas based on the presence of black households, which were considered toxic from an investment point of view. And only white families benefited from the dirt-cheap suburban homes. Sales to black families were prohibited, and racially restrictive covenants were required on all deeds. So, wasn't exactly perfect. Ah, thank you. So the result of all this was that white families were given tickets to the good life out in the suburbs. Black families remained in the segregated, underfunded, undermaintained projects, now only for the poorest of the poor. And some of these projects would become the isolated islands of crime and poverty and desperation that showed up on the news in the 80s and 90s and caused the moral panic over criminal poverty. The lessons that the government and also the popular media have chosen to take from all this is that it just doesn't make sense, social or economic sense, for the public to take on the role of housing provider. That poor people just can't maintain their properties. That so-called concentrated poverty breeds toxic social ills. And that the private market is really the only sensible place for the provision of housing to take place. If anything at all, the only thing we can do is attempt to influence a private market housing system and through policy, through public policy. So the era of direct building, maintenance, and management of housing is over. The government doesn't build homes today. There's been a dramatic neoliberal sea change in housing policy since the 70s, and the trend in public housing has been toward A, watching them decay and then demolishing them so that private developers can build mixed income developments, or B, watching them decay and then providing subsidies for private landlords to take over operating them. The first option I'm describing is basically Hope 6, which was predicated on the deconcentration of poverty and the eradication of cultural strongholds, the notorious demonized projects. And the second is seen in the rental assistance demonstration program, which started under Obama and has quickly become Ben Carson's favorite housing panacea solution. So instead of building or renovating social housing, which is a total of $49 billion in deferred maintenance, this program converts these buildings to private ownership. Meanwhile, tenants either move back into the now privately owned buildings and are relocated using Section 8 vouchers. This is because while funding for public housing has completely bottomed out, Section 8 or housing choice vouchers are still politically viable. This is where the government basically pays the landlord the difference between market rate and what they can supposedly afford to pay, which is 30% of their income. Instead of spending money on reliable, steady housing, the government provides subsidies to private landlords who accept Section 8 tenants. And instead of having a stable, reliable home, these already vulnerable families are forced out into the private market where they, you know, basically have to fend for themselves. This is also extremely problematic from a fair housing perspective, since most landlords refuse to accept voucher holders. And in Texas, and also Indiana, it's not only legal for landlords to discriminate on the basis of family's source of income, it's actually state law that no city can prevent that from happening. So basically, landlords can legally deny a family simply because they'll be paying with a voucher, majority of which are people of color. And these trends have led us really far away from the New Deal era of direct provision, but it's important not to mistake this for a retreat from state involvement in housing. And clearly the state is still very much involved. It's crafting policy, selling off assets, displacing tenants, only it isn't building housing anymore. The policy tide has turned from state provision of housing toward attempts to steer the market into providing it. Okay, awesome. I'm going to try to finish up. So the recent popularity of the YIMBY movement, or Yes in My Backyard, is illustrative of the current tendency away from demands for social housing and toward deregulation of housing markets. The idea is if we remove all the pesky barriers to development, then we get more housing, which will filter down to working people. It's like Reaganomics for housing. And for some reason, progressive people like it. But the filtering is total bullshit, and building luxury homes is never actually going to get us to guaranteed affordable housing. This is completely ass backwards. Sorry for my language. The biggest source of below market rate housing today is the low-income housing tax credit, or LIHTC. The IRS program offers competitive tax advantages to developers who include some affordable units in their buildings, which means lost tax revenue for the government that could be used for housing. And it also means that these homes are under no obligation to remain affordable into the future. So LIHTC is serious business, a lot of money in LIHTC, and a lot of money in navigating LIHTC because it's very complicated. So in places where it hasn't been outlawed, the idea of inclusionary zoning is also another popular program that seeks to entice the private market to take care of housing. Inclusionary zoning requires that a portion of all residential development include below market rate units. This has been a big part of de Blasio's plan in New York, as those in New York can attest to, and it's been billed as a way for low-income residents to benefit from real estate booms, or at least weather them somehow. But in reality, it's become a way of extracting a meager benefit from a process that dramatically reshapes cities with little consideration for the people who are living in them. So speaking of reshaping cities, one of the most heated topics of conversation in housing has been gentrification, and everybody told me you have to talk about gentrification. So it's often explained as simply an explosion of white middle-class interest in colonizing inner cities and the subsequent cultural and economic shifts that accompany that process. But this is actually a really poor understanding of what's actually happening under the surface in gentrification. Neil Smith, the late geographer, described gentrification as a back-to-the-city movement for capital. The way he explains it, which I would argue is the best model that we have on the left, is the preconditions of gentrification are created through the highly unnatural process of neighborhood disinvestment. So once capital is anchored in the built environment, it's stuck there and it can't actually easily be moved. As time passes, a neighborhood may go through stages of disinvestment and neglect simply because it has become more profitable to let it deteriorate than to rebuild and turn the land over to new use, like new housing or public space or whatever. At this stage, you see slumlords sitting on decaying properties and milking them for rent payments without making any repairs or upgrades. And I've lived in a building like that, so I know what that is like. When neighborhoods get bad enough, in a bad enough state of disinvestment, a sufficient rent gap exists between what can be charged currently for the use of the land and what could be charged if the land were turned over to another use. So it becomes worth it to make a big shift. And at this point, the area is ripe for gentrification or the closing of that rent gap. Especially if the neighborhood is located close to the city center, where simple proximity makes the gap even wider, and the city grows outwards and becomes more expensive. I'm almost done. So this rent gap explanation clarifies why poor neighborhoods, often inhabited by marginalized people of color, redlined for decades and deprived of city services, suddenly find themselves facing down bulldozers and speculators after decades of being ignored. So this is seeking to kind of explain that tendency. This decline in disinvestment is an essential period of the process that enables gentrification to emerge. So when we see neighborhoods in decline, potentially, but not always, gentrification comes in the future. A few conclusions that come from this are, first, gentrification is not inevitable. A lot of people talk about it as an inevitable process, and the decline that enables it isn't inevitable either. It's often facilitated by policies that devalue neighborhoods, for example, industrial zoning or mortgage redlining or being cut off from receiving infrastructure improvements, siting of freeways, really common in the infrastructure talk we talked about that, and other hazardous things. It doesn't simply happen as a result of the ravages of time that cause buildings to become outdated and need of revitalization. It's an attempt to capitalize on the rent gap that's been opened up by intentional and avoidable neglect. Second, the tired cultural preference explanations are just not sufficient to explain gentrification. It isn't happening because the suburbs suck and white people just got tired of living there. Though they do, and a lot of white people probably did get tired of living there, gentrification may appear to the naked eye as cereal restaurants and cold brew and bike lanes, but the economic processes happening under the surface are much more than that, and these surface explanations are great if we want to characterize gentrification as an inevitable process based on supply and demand and consumer choice, but they completely miss the deeper social relations, and I'd argue if they'll lead to unfortunate conclusions about how we should fight gentrification. So we can talk about that in the discussion, please. Finally, while housing policy has gone through a lot of shifts, there are some solutions that will always be off the table under capitalism. This includes the universal right to housing and building of mass social housing to actually provide for this right, the abolition of all rent and private landlordship, off the table. Even policies that threaten commodification and private property are usually fiercely controversial, like rent control or providing public housing for the middle class or strong protection for evictions. I'm sorry. So the reforms that we're left with are either on one hand those that preserve the profit-motivated status quo or those that we're able to demand. The unavoidable truth is that the problem of perpetual housing crisis won't be solved under capitalism, but that can't stop us from using our collective power to push for demands that will raise the living standards and expectations. And in fact, in the face of these dire conditions that I've described in this talk, we can't afford not to do this. Housing has to be on the agenda, which is why I'm going to leave it there. And Tim is going to expand on some of these demands and movements and visions for a truly liberatory housing system. Before I hand it off to Tim, we wanted to take about 10 minutes for a brief discussion. And if everybody sees, if they didn't hear Owen describe this, every three people or so has one of these. The top four questions at the top, these are the things that we wanted you all to think about before we go into Tim's talk. So first of all, if you can't see it, what housing issues exist in your city? What have you seen around you? What are some examples of housing struggles, big or small, that you've witnessed? How would your life be different if quality, publicly funded housing were guaranteed to all people? What parts of your life would change? Be creative, think about that. What role did housing play in major struggles of the past? You all come from different activist backgrounds and different historical knowledge. Did you see housing play a role in those things? And based on the timeline, if you have a second to look at it, do you see any relationship to housing and how housing has changed over time and other historical events? Okay, so we're gonna take 10 minutes. Talk with the people around you. Whoever has a paper can be the center of the discussion.
Morning, everyone. Happy first full day of conference. So moving into the second half of this talk, as Amelia said, I'm going to focus more on housing struggles and how socialists should understand them. And I'm going to start by taking us back 100 years to New York City in 1918, where William Carlin, who was a Socialist Party candidate for municipal court judge, was addressing a mass meeting of the East Side Tenants League. One of several socialist speakers that evening, he called for tenants to seize tenement houses from landlords and run them in their own interests. He said, quote, "The Socialist Party does not say that you should pay less rent. It says you shouldn't pay any rent."
Yeah.
Pretty great. Right? "It is in the socialist program that the people shall take the homes and the land and keep it," end quote. As Robert Fogelson describes in his excellent book, The Great Rent Wars, this radical call to overturn the power of the landlords came at a time in a context of a genuine crisis of housing affordability and militant resistance. A severe housing shortage that began during World War I and continued after it emboldened landlords to impose drastic rent increases. And a permissive state government empowered landlords to give tenants only monthly leases at a time. So landlords took advantage of this by raising rent anywhere from 10 to 30%, sometimes as much as 100% or more, each month. With virtually no empty housing on the market, tenants were forced to either leave the city and relocate, or more frequently, to find any possible ways to cut back on expenses, such as eating fewer meals, reusing tattered clothing, and renting any available space they could find, and makeshift sleeping surface to boarders. Evictions reached such an astronomical number that municipal court judges were each expected to hear hundreds of cases just for evictions per day, which overwhelmed the legal system. When asked by a municipal committee what tenants could do or be expected to do in the light of such a crisis, one landlord simply replied, "Grin and bear it." Yet though many tenants saw no other options than to bear the impossibly high costs of housing, many others did organize and fight back, launching a wave of rent strikes, building tenant unions and associations, and linking the class struggles that were exploding throughout industry at the time to the home. To be sure, it wasn't the first wave of rent strikes that New York City had seen in the early part of the 20th century. And the honor for that likely goes to a group of Jewish women garment workers who, in 1904, organized hundreds of families to refuse to pay rent increases, and in some cases, to refuse to pay their rent at all. They picketed landlords' homes, and they set up picket lines outside struck tenement houses and physically blocked potential new residents, who they called scabs, from moving in to the struck houses, or struck units. However, while the rent strike wave of 1904 to 1905 was primarily limited to Eastern European immigrant communities, the strike wave that came from 1917 to 1920 was far broader and encompassed a wider and more diverse range of participants, with tenant unions forming from Harlem to Brownsville, although it wouldn't be until the 1930s that the particular struggles of black tenants would be brought into the movement. Just as importantly, the Socialist Party, which had largely been on the sidelines of the earlier waves of rent struggles, took on a leading role in this new wave of rent strikes. And within the movement, it was primarily women who were expected to manage their family's finances and pay rent as part of their overall social reproductive responsibilities that organized their families and their neighbors to go on strike, block scab residents from entering the building, and in some cases, battle the police as well. The linkages between the socialist left and the tenant movement and the growing militancy of tenants altogether terrified the city's elite. Red flags flew from windows. Families proudly carry signs saying, "This house is on a rent strike," and you can see a picture of one of those in your handout. One landlord even reported the formation of what he called a tenant Soviet in the building, which was formed by residents and which had collected rent from all the residents and held onto it as leverage against the landlord. Another landlord, Harry Minarski, reported to a local newspaper about his experiences after raising monthly rent $4, which of course was a much greater sum of money at the time. He testified that his tenants not only began threatening his life, but started marching through the streets carrying an empty coffin with a sign attached reading, "Here lies Minarski." The newspaper reported that the sign did not include "Rest in Peace." Minarski soon after sold his building and fled out of fear. After years of struggles, strikes, and evictions, New York City passed the emergency rent laws, which imposed early forms of the eviction protections and rent control that still exist to some degree in New York City, though, of course, they are under severe assault. The movement did not survive the Red Scare repression of the 1920s that saw the destruction of the labor movement as a whole, as well as a severe repression of left-wing organizations, though housing would again become a major part of labor struggles during the 1930s and the Great Depression. And I wanted to begin with this history because for me it illustrates at least two things. First, it demonstrates that we can win better and affordable housing only through struggles linked and organized by class organizations, such as tenant unions, that are deeply rooted at the neighborhood level among residents. And to me, that suggests that the question of how and where to start building these organizations is a critical one for the growing socialist left. Second, it demonstrates that we actually can win. It's one thing to simply recognize the necessity of struggle, and it's another thing to altogether to recognize the potential for organizing and winning that struggle right now and acting on that conviction. And I think one benefit of studying this history is the confidence is to gain that confidence to act today, whether or not we're engaged in housing work, recognizing that it's a long and difficult struggle, but it's one that we can actually win if we try. In the time that I have during my talk, I'm going to try to do a couple things. First, I'm going to give a very broad overview of how to understand housing struggles from a socialist perspective. Of course, because I have very limited time, I'm going to only be able to speak in very broad terms. But then I'm going to shift to focus specifically on the transformative potential of a demand for a 21st century public housing program, recognizing the limitations that Miller pointed out with the way that the program was implemented in the 20th century, and the potential for that as a demand for the socialist movement. I hope during the discussion portion we can share thoughts on the theory as well as our own experiences with housing and housing struggles, as I know there's a lot of knowledge and experience in this room that we can all collectively learn from. So mainstream discussions of affordable and fair housing are often limited to the question of formal rights, the right to decent housing, the right to be able to stay in place, and so on. And if we limit our analysis simply to the realm of legal rights, we could, you know, the picture isn't as bad as it might seem. You know, we could understand the ongoing housing crisis, like Amelia talked about, as simply an aberration from international norms. Numerous international treaties, such as Article 25 of the UN's Declaration of Human Rights, guarantees rights to housing. Dozens of countries around the world, I think nearly 70, have officially enshrined a right to housing in their national constitutions. In the United States, the Housing Act of 1949 called for, quote, "the realization as soon as feasible of the goal of a decent home and a suitable living environment for every American family," end quote. But formal recognition of a general right to housing, while better than nothing and potentially useful as a foundation for organizing and making demands, never automatically translates into genuine access to affordable, let alone publicly funded housing, precisely because housing is so deeply connected to the production of profit, like Amiri talked about. It's for this reason that the same 1949 Housing Act that called for decent homes for everyone, and in reality actually funded the so-called urban renewal projects that demolished entire black communities, entrenched racist segregation in virtually every city, and displaced a million people between 1949 and 1980, all to clear space for the profitable expansion of real estate capital. So more than a question of rights, housing is always a question of power. Who controls the land, who decides how it's used, who is allowed to access it and who is not, and so on. The relative size, strength, and militancy of political organizations and social movements, those of our side and those of our class enemies, are always decisive in determining whether land and housing are used for the interests of private profit or to meet human needs. Given the centrality of the home, both to our physical existence and the capitalism of the system, almost every mass radicalizing movement within the United States over the last century has eventually been forced to grapple with the question of housing, though the forms this has taken have varied. from the efforts of the Communist Party to block evictions in the 1930s, to the Occupy Our Homes movement from 2011 to 2012 to block foreclosures as part of the Occupy movement. Many of these struggles have emerged around immediate questions of fighting rent and stopping evictions, like the example I started off with, but others have come about around questions of social oppression, from women fighting against domestic violence and subordination within the household, to black families and other people of color fighting state-sanctioned racist terrorism simply to live in their homes, to LGBT youth fighting and facing homelessness on a daily basis, to people with disabilities fighting to have access to accessible and quality housing without discrimination. Housing struggles inevitably illuminate the intersections of social oppression and class exploitation, though not every housing struggle necessarily challenges both. Housing struggles also transcend national borders, just like real estate capital. Internationally, really the most significant housing struggles have not been in the United States, but in the so-called developing world. Countless thousands of peasants and those living in so-called slums have organized to fight mass displacement from enormous hydroelectric dam projects and other infrastructure projects in India and China. Palestinians, of course, continue to organize and bravely fight to resist Israel's demolitions of their homes and villages. The resistance organized by residents of favelas in Brazil to displacement caused by the 2016 Olympics electrified much of the world. And of course, there are many, many other examples that we can hopefully get to in the discussion. So these are all reasons why housing and housing struggles should take high priorities within Marxist analysis. While rent strikes, struggles against evictions, and similar actions don't have the capability to shut down the economy like a labor strike, they represent important moments of class struggle and a fundamental challenge to the interests of capital and property owners. And as housing development and gentrification become increasingly central to the economies of virtually every city, like Amelia talked about, housing struggles can take on a greater role than in previous eras where industry was the primary economic base. To some extent, we've seen a growing focus by parts of the left on questions of housing over the last few years. Most recently, we saw the struggle in Seattle to tax Amazon and other major companies to fund housing programs for the homeless, which Socialist Alternative, unions, and other left groups were involved in. Folks probably saw there was a compromise measure that was passed that was very significant, but was repealed, I think, within 2 weeks as something like four or five Democratic city council members were quickly flipped to oppose it and repeal it. This shows the corporate dictatorship that exists virtually everywhere. There's also been a focus by some comrades in the DSA, as well as some municipally-based socialist groups like Philly Socialists and others, to work towards building tenant unions. And though my argument is not that all socialists should prioritize housing work everywhere, regardless of local conditions, I think the current period of volatility and whiplash that we've been talking about has created new opportunities for socialist organizations to embark on experimenting with new initiatives. And I think this is a great opportunity to learn from each other and to continue developing the collaboration we've seen over the last year or two. And as socialists, I certainly think we have an important role to play within housing movements, not just as some of the most militant activists, but as those who can raise the broad and transformative kind of demands that can actually win housing for all if achieved. And this is precisely because we recognize that the ongoing crisis is the inevitable outcome of a system that values housing not as a place of residence, but as a piece of real estate to be sold at a profit, regardless of the human cost. Amelia talked about the solutions the liberal politicians present us with that often treat the housing crisis more as an unfortunate accident than as a part of the fundamental workings of the system. And so the key for us as socialists is to raise demands that challenge the commodification of housing under capitalism altogether as a part of a movement to upend the rule of capital once and for all. And for me, I see this as requiring a clear and unequivocal demand for fully funded and expanded public housing, alongside stringent rent control measures and eviction protections as well. And just to do some quick definitions, when I say public housing, I mean housing that is state-owned and that's provided at either no cost or at a fixed proportion of a tenant's income, which guarantees continued affordability regardless of market swings. And public housing, also known as social housing in different countries, has looked different in different countries depending on the scale and power of the labor movement and left-wing parties there. Where labor movements were more radical, where the working class succeeded in forming a labor party, social housing was far more expansive and available to more people, and more of it remains today than does in the United States. And of course, public housing can certainly be incorporated within a capitalist economy. The provisioning of housing by the state, when done in the interests of human need, can directly challenge the logic of real estate capital and the commodification of housing. In this way, it's similar to the demand for Medicare for all or free higher education for all people. Public housing has been the single most effective housing program in the U.S., ensuring that those who were in the greatest need of housing ultimately received it, even if just for a time. And for the last 30 years in particular, it's been under relentless attack, like Amelia talked about. ideological campaigns against public housing and social welfare in general has given political cover for gentrification, as public housing developments are demolished and residents displaced to make way for so-called mixed-income developments and luxury housing. Cities are scrambling to rid themselves of their public housing stock, with Atlanta being the first city in the country to reach that goal some years ago. The demand to not only stop the demolition of public housing, but to renovate and dramatically expand it, of course, may not seem very radical in a room full of socialists, activists, and leftists, but the reality is that it does remain extremely controversial, even within sections of the left. And for some, this is because the question of direct public ownership of land and provisioning of housing is kind of beyond their political horizons right now. But for others, including more than a few public housing residents, this opposition or this controversy becomes because public housing has come to represent poverty, abject decay, urban segregation, state racism, and a lack of opportunity, among other issues. And obviously, the second group is not unjustified in their concerns. I think any socialist defense of public housing must grapple with the reality that the program in the United States was the result of a particular set of compromises between capital and the state that limited its full potential. Despite being a demand being raised by black and white residents alike, public housing became in practice a tool for enforcing and entrenching racist segregation. Over time, funding cuts, state-assisted capital flight from city centers, and now mass demolition has led to severe deterioration of the public housing that remains, while enormous wait lists have made it virtually impossible for thousands of people who need it most to access the remaining public housing units. But it's also true that the residents, especially black families, since the existence of public housing, have organized and led massive fights to gain access to, improve, democratize, and defend their public housing. This history of oppression and injustice, alongside the organizing of struggle and struggle of residents, must be understood in relationship to each other, and a socialist demand for a 21st century public housing program must learn from all these lessons in their totality. And perhaps this is just as important as the question of affordability. An expansive public housing program, one that prioritized those with the most need, but was open to all people, would eliminate the threat of homelessness that keeps so many working class people, especially working class women and LGBT folks, in unstable and abusive households and jobs. Rhonda Williams notes in her excellent book, The Politics of Public Housing, Black Women's Struggles Against Urban Inequality, which we have right there and is in the Haymarket Room, that public housing was a lifeline for black and white women alike, allowing them to leave abusive or just unhappy marriages and still support their children without fear of losing their homes. The dramatic expansion of public housing could also decrease rents for housing in general, and by extension, the profits and power of landlords, by increasing the overall supply of housing and affordable housing in particular. This radical potential wasn't realized with the U.S. public housing program that was created in the 30s due to a compromise with the real estate sector that promised to demolish one unit of slum housing for each unit of public housing that was constructed. But a genuinely successful public housing program would be forced to upend these compromises altogether. Of course, you know, it's not really possible to outline a winning strategy for expanding public housing in a 20-minute talk. I think we should at least start by studying the history of struggle that public housing residents themselves organized and sometimes won. Among many others, these include the former residents of the demolished Pruitt-Igoe development in St. Louis, which was captured brilliantly in the documentary The Pruitt-Igoe Myth, which I definitely recommend checking out, who in 1969 organized, led, and won a 9-month rent strike against rent increases, insufficient social services, and for crucially needed repairs and greater democracy and decision making. As Jean King, a mother and public housing tenant who helped lead the strike, put it, quote, "When we get our demands, the housing authority will get their money and not a minute before," end quote. The question of fighting for genuinely fair, accessible, and affordable housing inevitably means raising questions of coalitions between housing struggles and other social and labor struggles. The Pruitt-Igoe rent strike and the broad organizing of countless black women public housing tenants in particular during that era were the outcome of the merging of the black freedom struggles of the 1960s and the housing struggles and welfare rights struggles that have been going on since the creation of the welfare system in the 1930s. Moving forward, I think it's absolutely crucial that the socialist left take on questions of housing and housing struggles as central areas for us to study today, and that we all collaborate to learn effective strategies for organizing and fighting together to not only stop gentrification and displacement, but to fight for the decommodification of housing altogether.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.